Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 355, I chat with re-recording mixer Mike Minkler about his work on the original Star Wars, which debuted in theaters exactly 40 years ago. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded May 25th, 2017. Episode 355, Star Wars 40th Anniversary. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week is a very special episode of Home Theater Geeks. I have as my guest three-time Academy Award-winning re-recording engineer, Mike Minkler. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Good. Thank you so much. From China, no less. You're actually in China working on a movie over there. And so you were so gracious to agree to get up and be on my show at what is your time, 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, the reason I invited you to come on the show is that today, this very day, May 25th, 2017, is the 40th anniversary of the theatrical release of the original Star Wars. And Mike, you worked on Star Wars, the original movie, and that's what I want to talk about today. But before we get to that, I want to make sure everybody knows that those who are watching live at live.twit.tv can log into the chat room there, or you can go to irc.twit.tv and post questions, and I will pass along as many as I can during the time we have together. Now, I want to, first of all, recognize your accomplishments, of which there are many. As I mentioned, 3 Academy Awards for Best Sound for Black Hawk Down, Chicago, and Dreamgirls. 3 BAFTA Awards, that's the British Academy of Film and Television Arts, basically the British Oscars, for Star Wars, JFK, and Chicago. 3 Cinema Audio Society Awards, including a Lifetime Achievement Award. An Emmy Award for The Pacific, and the Motion Picture Sound Editors Award for Born on the 4th of July. You're a busy guy.
Yeah, well, if you're around long enough, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly. So let's start with, how did you get hooked up with George Lucas and the original Star Wars?
Okay, well, my father, who had... was in the business, and of course his father was in the business. So I'm a third generation sound person.
Wow.
My father's very good friend and partner was a gentleman named Jim Nelson, who was a very accomplished sound editor at the time, back then, and throughout the 60s and 70s. And Jim was hired by George Lucas and Gary Kurtz as the post-production supervisor of Star Wars. And so when it came to the post-production sound, Jim reached out to my dad and a few of his other friends and put the team together. And he hired Sam Shaw to do to be the supervising sound editor. And then he came to me and my team, which was made up of Les Fresholtz and Art Pianodosi. Those were my mixing partners at the time. At Warner Brothers, dubbing 5. And so Jim selected us, and we had to do an interview, and Gary Kurtz and George Lucas came down, and we met and we talked, and we showed them a reel of Marooned, which had just been released like a year or two earlier, but it was a film that Les and Art had mixed. And just so that George and Gary could get a feel for the room and see if they liked it. And they did. And they decided to, that we were the team for them. And so we did the film.
Mm. Got a couple pictures I just wanted to show of George Lucas on the set of Star Wars as they were shooting it, because it's quite interesting to see these people that we know so well, so young, you know, still shooting, well, still shoot, obviously shooting on film cameras. That's now pretty much gone by the wayside. There's George Lucas with Chewbacca and a few other people. It was a different time then. You were obviously starting out your career, I guess, at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, I was 24. I think George was like 30 or 31 at the time. Yeah, I had been mixing for only a couple of years at that time. And I was very young, which I think probably was to my advantage, because I didn't have any preconceived notions as to what to do or how to do it. I didn't know the rules. So I just made up my own rules. And I think that was one of the things that George liked about me, is that I was willing to just do anything or try anything.
Whatever worked, huh? The best way to get something to work.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, his very, very close friend, Ben Burtt, who was the designer of all of the unique sounds of Star Wars, you know, he had the same guideline, which was just, you know, just do anything you want, do anything that works. And Ben is, you know, extremely creative. And so he just made all this stuff up in his head and went out and performed it and brought all the material to us.
Well, we're going to get into some of the sounds that he made here in a bit. But I wanted to also, you had sent to me some a note about George Lucas's mandate to Sam Shaw. What was that?
I don't want any sound in this movie that has ever been used before.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so everything was created specifically for the movie, which was pretty unique at the time, because most people were using sound effects libraries, and George would not have that. So everything has to be created new. So it was a first in many, many different ways, and that was certainly one of the ways that that the sound of Star Wars was unique.
Yeah,
and it meant creating a lot of tracks in order to create environments, in order to create the entire composite sound. Up to that point, I think most films only had 10, 15, 20 sound effects tracks playing at a time. I think that was like the biggest that there ever were. Reel one of Star Wars had 320. It was quite a departure. Very unique.
And especially difficult, given that there was nothing like Pro Tools or anything like that, where you could easily have hundreds or thousands of tracks. This was all on tape machines, right?
35 millimeter mag machines. And they had to be loaded, and you could only put it. Well, we had a very large machine room, but we could only load 35 at a time. So we had to premix, and again, and premixing had not been done up until that point. I'm sure it had been done slightly, a little bit, but we had to premix all of these tracks because there's no way to play them. So we would put up as many as we would dare put up for that particular food group, and we would premix it in stereo and then put up the next batch and the next batch and the next batch, and then create these. We created a couple of hundred four-track stereo premixes.
What do you mean four-track stereo? I mean, stereo doesn't actually mean two channels, but it has come to mean that, at least in the consumer world.
Yeah. If you look at the evolution of sound in motion pictures, the stereo movement started in 1953 with four-track CinemaScope, MAG, and in 1956 with six-track Todd AO MAG. These were composite prints that had picture and sound on them, and the sound was actually put on a magnetic stripe onto the film. So both of those formats had pretty much died by 1977. So two things were happening simultaneously. Dolby was working on an optical two-track encoded system that would not be mag. It would be an optical track just on the side of the film, like most other films were, had mono track. This was a two-track stereo track. Their idea was to record, well, listen in four-track, encode it into two, and have it played back into four.
This was the matrixing technology, sometimes called LTRT.
Correct. So that was just getting going. That started in, I think, only two or three films had been done prior to Star Wars. And they weren't really done that successfully. The technology was still in its infancy, and they were improving it all the time. So while that two-track stereo was being introduced, six-track was also dying. And so when George said he wanted this movie to be 70mm six-track, our initial response was, okay, we'll do the Todd AO spread, which is you do a four-track mix and you fill in the left extra and right extra in the front speakers with material from the left and center and the right and center. That was our initial idea. So we started making four-track premixes, which was a three-channel mag for the across the front and a mono mag for the surround.
Which is what Dolby Stereo was. It was LTRT, right and left, two-channel, but encoded, matrixed in with that was a center channel and a single surround channel, right?
Correct. But the separation between those channels was in Dolby Stereo was horrible. It was only 2 dB at the time, and we wanted discrete channels. So we went mag, we went discrete, and we started doing these four-track stereo premixes. And that was unique at the time as well, because nobody was panning from front to back ever. And I said, I was like, you know, well, why not? Why can't I? So I did. I mean, there were no pan pots that were created to do that. So I would just do it with faders. So we were panning all around the room in four-track stereo on all of these premixes. And it was rather unique. Then what happened was we could not get the low-end energy that we wanted, particularly in the opening scene when Vader's cruiser goes overhead chasing Leia's ship. I mean, that was the moment, right? And we just could not get low end happening with the technology that we're using today, back then, that we were using Altec A4 speakers. And so the left extra, right extra, there was a Dolby consultant at the time. His name was Steve Katz. He had this idea that since we're mixing in left, center, right, and surround, and what if we don't do the Todd spread and put those in the channels 2 and 4 in the front? What if we use 2 and 4 for low frequency only?
Put in, so this was the birth of material. LFE?
This was the birth of LFE, and this was called Baby. We named it Baby Boom.
Pretty appropriate for the people who were working on the movie at that time, I'd say.
Yeah. Baby Boom evolved 2 years later in Apocalypse Now, where I'm just completely blanking out here.
Yeah, I think you're thinking of Colonel Kurtz, one of the characters.
Yeah, you're right. But Walter Murch had the idea in Apocalypse Now that instead of using 2 and 4 for boom, why not take 2 and 4 and put those into as separate surrounds? So making, instead of mono, but now have stereo surrounds, and then the sixth channel, which used to be for surrounds, use that for the boom. So Apocalypse was the first movie that did a true 5.1. And that was derived from the Baby Boom.
What do you know? Well, actually, I have a little YouTube clip, number one, of Vader's ship chasing Leia's ship. And I think what we want to hear here is the low frequency, which obviously is very important. Also, the panning. I think you must have done a panning from back to front in this particular case, right?
Right.
Josh, if you can play that clip number one. That's great. We're going to play a few more clips here, but obviously that had a lot of low frequency energy in it. And again, a pan from back to front, which was unique. Yep. Star Wars was the first one where that was being done, right?
Yes, as far as I know, yes. And it took a lot to accomplish that. There's obviously a lot of tracks being played there. There's the shots and the as well as the ship sounds itself, and then, of course, the low-frequency energy. So, mixing back then was kind of like performance art. You had to do this stuff live because we didn't have computers. We didn't have automation that we could preset certain things, certain moves were recalled. This was live. So it's like every man, grab your faders, grab your pen, or grab your whatever, and let's do this, you know. And
no automation in those days.
No.
Wow. No. A couple questions in the chat room. Emily the Strange is asking, can you explain what premixes are?
Yeah, well, prior to Star Wars, most movies had only a limited number of tracks, and consoles were large enough, and they used three-man crews or four-man crews, and you could put each man had enough channels in front of him, 6, 8, or 10, maybe 12, and they would just start mixing the movie. And where Star Wars had just had so many tracks, there was no way to do that. So we had to make premix of the ship sound, premix of the gun, the cannon fire, a premix of the lasers, a premix. You divided everything up into groups. And so then when you go to the final mix, you put up these premixes that were controlled. They were already pre-panned. They were already pre-EQ'd, pre-reverbed. Those were embedded into the premixes so that when you went into the final, you weren't trying to turn 500 knobs. You just had these pre-made premixes.
So in a sense, were they like stems? These days, yeah. You know, we talk about the dialogue stem and the music stem and the sound effects stem. This was sort of like that?
Yeah. The first thing you do now these days is you make premixes, and then those premixes are used to make the final. And back then the final was always on one piece of film. So that was before stems. And I think I was the first one ever did stems. And that was in 1980 when I moved from Warner Brothers over to Lionsgate, and we rebuilt that room. And I put in three recorders, three six track recorders, and I divided it up into dialogue stem, a music stem, and an effects stem. So that each man could control his own doing, because otherwise you're all going to the same recorder. So if one guy messes up, the other two guys, you back up and you have to do it again. It's a reperforming.
As you said earlier, it was actually a live performance, essentially.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Amazing. with the screen name THX1138, very good screen name for today's show in particular. Would like to know, why was there a unique mono mix? Why wasn't it just folded down from the stereo mix? First of all, is he correct?
Yes. You would never fold down a six-track mix into a mono. It wouldn't work. So there's always a separate mono pass made. Now, these days, we're a lot more advanced in our technology. You could actually take the stems of a six-track mix and make a crash down into a mono dialogue, mono music, and mono effects. It wouldn't be balanced properly, but it could be used.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, after they finished the six-track mix and shipped it, they went into the mono mode. And using the same premixes that I had made, the gentleman made the mono version. And they spent another 3 or 4 weeks making the mono version. And in mono, it was much easier for them to back up and jump in and go forward and continue with that particular recording session. Now, the reason I bring that up is insert recording, as it was known then, which is if you mess something up, you stop, you back up, which was also brand new at the time. You could back up in sync and then roll forward and jump in and continue recording. Not too many places could do that. Now, Star Wars was mixed in two different studios with two different crews. And the reason that is we started the mix. We spent 7 weeks on it at Warner Brothers. And the mix had to, George had to vacate our mix room because we were committed. We were Warner Brothers, so we were committed to our next project, which was The Exorcist Part 2, The Heretic. That's a whole other story that I never want to
repeat. We're going to get to that another time.
Yeah. George, Star Wars was basically kicked out. And there was a meeting that took place like on week 6. And George was notified that he had to vacate. And we all got together and we had to come up with a place and a crew to take over for us. So we put together a crew, and the facility that we chose was Samuel Goldwyn, and Stage D. And we put the crew together of Don McDougall, Ray West, and Bob Minkler. So Bob Minkler took over my position as the sound effects mixer. Don McDougall did music, and Ray West did dialogue. They did the final mix of Star Wars. We never did it.
Oh, really?
We had to hand it off. Now, I went, they started mixing at night. And it was because the facility couldn't accommodate them in the daytime. There wasn't a whole lot of choices of studios where you could make a movie like this. So it was limited and was difficult to like get the room with the crew and the rest of the facility, the support team. So we put this thing together. I would mix in the daytime on the Heretic, and at nighttime I would go to Goldwyn and sit with that crew and try to explain everything to them.
Oh man, how difficult that must have been.
It was very difficult, but I was very young and dumb and willing to do it. So, I had to show everybody, these are the dialogue tracks, these are the creature tracks, these are the sound effects tracks, these are the Foley tracks, this is the backgrounds, and this is what we're going to do with this, is why we're... I tell you, the look on people's faces the very first time we put everything up for a final mix, including the music that no one had ever heard, and the minute we started rolling through it, we got to the end of Reel 1. I mean, everyone in the room's faces were like in shock. No one had ever seen anything like that. Mm. The picture editors were there. John Williams was there. George and Gary and the mixers themselves were like, "My God, what do we have in front of us?"
Mm.
And so I sat with them for a week and tried to get them going. They did the final mix over a 3-week period of time, and then they went into mono mode. And it was a very difficult final mix because of the lack of capabilities of being able to jump in. Now, Goldwyn was a good studio, but they could not insert record. So these guys had to make passes and without backing up and insert recording. So they had to make passes of these reels, and then the sound editor would cut together the best of those passes, and that would be the front three-track stereo mix. Then they'd go back to the top and do a surround pass, because they couldn't do front and back recordings simultaneously. So they'd do a surround pass, and then they made a third pass, which was the low-frequency pass.
It was
very rough on them because of the technology.
Or the lack thereof at that point. You guys were working with state-of-the-art technology in 1977.
Yeah. Well, our stage, we had a pretty unique solid-state Quad-A console that was kind of pretty cool at the time. They had an older Quad-A console that still had rotary knobs.
Oh, man.
So, oh, yeah.
Wow. Well, I got a couple more questions here. User 5982 is asking, what exactly is in the LFE, which stands for low frequency effects? What do they put in there to create that extra bass? Why did we even need an extra bass? You started to discuss that a little bit a while ago.
Well, like for Star Wars, it's obviously the ships, it's the explosions. You want that extra punch, that power. What it evolved into was very specific subwoofer systems that were immediately introduced by 1980. Pretty much everybody had now installed subwoofer channels into their mix rooms, and the theater started to adopt that also. So it's low frequency only. It's audio that is cut off at about 150 cycles and pumped into these very specific low frequency speakers. They're used mostly by sound effects for like the big, like I said, explosions or, you know, big moments. But music will also use them, and sometimes even dialogue may use it. I just used it extensively on dialogue and vocals in the movie Beauty and the Beast. The Beast voice is in the sub.
No kidding. You mean the recent Beauty and the Beast that was just released a little while ago?
Yes.
That was a great movie, by the way. I thought the soundtrack was phenomenal. So wonderful job there. User 9815 is asking, did you realize how big of a deal this movie was going to be when you were working on it? And clearly your story of when George and everybody came in and heard it for the first time, the final sort of soundtrack, maybe you were starting to get an idea that this was going to be something pretty big, huh?
I realized it about 3 weeks into our pre-mixing. I just turned to the guys and I said, I think this is going to be the biggest movie I ever work on. And they were like, really? I mean, it's kind of, I'm telling you, the guys, there's something about this movie. And I don't know, I felt it then.
Yeah. So you were aware that this was something special.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me tell you, the first time anybody ever saw it, and I know you're going to get to this, you said you found an invitation to the cast and crew screening.
Yes.
There was 1,100 people at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater at the Academy in Beverly Hills, and it was the first time anybody had ever seen the movie, and I think even George had never seen the final print. It was a brand new print that came out that morning from the lab, 70mm, 6-track, and it was almost like a check run as much as it was a cast and crew screening. So 1,100 people who had all worked on the movie, but nobody had ever seen it put together, saw it for the first time. And my God, when that ship came over their heads in the opening scene, they went apish for minutes. And then when the movie was over, it was a 15-minute standing ovation. I mean, the yelling, the screaming, the hoopla, the cheering, all throughout the movie. It was mind blowing.
Well, we might as well show that picture I found of the cast screening invite. Check that out. Somebody put that on, you know, posted that somewhere, and I found it. And you must have gotten one of these.
I did, and I had one for a long. I don't know what happened to it, but I did keep it.
So that was May 21st, and that was the first time anyone had ever seen the movie. And then it was released to the public on May 25th. And there are actually a couple of shots I have of that event, too. It was at, the premiere was at the Grauman's Chinese, at that time still called the Grauman's, I believe.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Pretty highly anticipated. I myself was in, I saw it in San Francisco, probably not on the 25th per se, but I was living in Northern California at the time, and I saw it there. There's another sort of more close-up of people waiting to see this amazing movie.
Yeah.
Emily the Strange in the chat room is asking, were you involved in mixing in the mixing of the music, of the score by John Williams?
No, not at all. No, it was done in London, and it just, it arrived. Don McDougall was the re-recording mixer who took care, who handled the music. But that music came in six-track mag. And so it was already mixed down, but it was usually back then it was pretty well mixed down into one six track. Sometimes it was two or three six tracks. Today you would have stems. You would have 5.1 stems. You'd have many, many, many tracks to handle.
Right, but they would get mixed down to 5.1 in the music stem, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the notes you sent me, you said you had a story about coining the phrase "a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away."
Well, I didn't personally coin that phrase, but during that first introductory meeting with George and Gary and Jim Nelson, they had shown us some of the images, and they didn't show us very much of the footage, but they showed us some of the images. And during the course of the conversation, I said something like, "Well, it's, I'm really looking forward to this. I've never worked on a futuristic movie with, you know, spaceships, and it's going to be really amazing to work on." And George looked at me totally serious, deadpan look. He says, "This happened a long time ago in a different galaxy."
So he already knew. This wasn't the future. This was the past.
This was the past. And then he said 10,000 years ago, you know.
Oh, man.
No, I didn't know. And so I think he was like cutting off. He was already in his mind that I better let people know that this happened a long time ago in a different galaxy. So he put it on there.
What do you know? So it was because you thought that it was in the future that he said, "No, it's in the past. I better make that clear."
I that's my story.
Okay,
I'm sticking to it.
And you're sticking to it. All right. I that's fine. I want to play a little bit of the a few of the sound effects. And I know you weren't involved in actually making the sound effects. That was Ben Burt. But they're pretty cool, and you can tell us something about them. YouTube clip number two is the blaster sounds, the sounds of the laser guns that are firing. Let's give a little listen to that. So, there you have a lot of blaster sounds.
Yeah.
And so, there we go. Okay, that's enough for now. That's a lot of blaster sounds. And the story of how Ben Burt came up with those is kind of interesting, which I'm sure you know, at least.
I've heard all the stories from Ben himself, and but I've forgotten them. And I know that he's chronicalized what he did in books and things, in interviews.
Right. So I had heard originally that they were tapping on the cables of the Golden Gate Bridge, but that turned out not to be true.
There was something that had to do with guy wires. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly where, what, but yeah.
Okay, well, I actually found a picture of it. Josh showed it a little earlier. They're guy wires or support wires for a radio antenna that he found. He was out walking, taking a stroll or whatever, and he found these. And I guess he bumped into them or tripped over them or something and said, wow, that's a really cool sound.
Yeah.
So there's a picture of him actually recording that sound, and he's following George's mandate of, I don't want any library sounds. I want all original sounds here.
Yeah. Yeah. Ben probably came up with a couple of hundred sounds, like I said, and they were completely unique, including languages from the Jawas.
And yes, from exactly.
The Ewoks. And you know, he provided all of that material, and of course, Sam then had to put it together.
Right. We actually have a clip of the Jawa voices. I found this clip. This is clip number 5, Josh. I found this clip, and it's not from the movie. I guess it is in a way, but it's kind of the Jawa voices extracted out of the movie. Let's give a listen to that.
Utini.
Utini. I love that particular word. And you say that probably is actually derived from a language.
That's what Ben said. Yes, it's an African language, I think. And, of course, it's pitched up, it's sped up. But I think that is an actual language, yeah.
Yeah, and pitched, you exactly, to make it sound very high-pitched and kind of nasally or whatever. I've always been interested in the fighter sounds, and that's actually YouTube clip number 6. Let's give a listen to clip number 6 here, and then I have a particular question to ask you about that.
There's too much interference.
Red 5, can you hear where you are?
No sign of any.
Wait, coming in 0.35.
I see them.
I'm in range. Target's coming up.
Just hold them off for a few seconds.
There's a formation.
Almost there.
Let it loose.
They're right behind me.
Almost there.
I can't hold them.
Didn't go in.
Just impacted on the surface.
Okay, that's good. Thank you very much. So that the sound of the Imperial fighters in particular, the TIE fighters, has always impressed me, always sounded to me like screaming. And is that correct? Did they actually derive that from people screaming?
No, it's an animal. And I've forgotten which animal it was. I think I've remembered stories of elephants and lions or tigers, but they're, you know, it's derived from animal screams.
Animal screams. Okay. And I always thought that was appropriate because, you know, the Empire is evil and their fighters sound like they're screaming at you and stuff like that. So I just thought that was pretty interesting. Let's see.
I've got another interesting tidbit about this.
Please.
When we were pre-mixing, a lot of the visual effects were not finished, especially the dogfights in the last reel. So what we had to work with was footage of World War II battles. And actually, the visual effects people also worked with World War II footage. The picture editors edited the World War II bombers and fighters, which represented the X-Wing fighters and the TIE fighters, right into the movie. Black and white World War II footage.
And wow.
And the model, the visual effects guys at ILM shot their models to match the World War II footage. And so we did a lot of the premixes to the World War II footage.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. And so when the final imagery was put in, they actually mimicked the World War II dogfights with these fighters, which at that time were models, right? They weren't, there was no digital effects.
Right. I did visit the Industrial Light and Magic during that time. And yes, they had computerized cameras on dollies, and they had models that were maybe the size of, you know, maybe 12 inches long. And they had the star fields, and they had the Death Star, and they had all these things. And it was all black in these black rooms, and the cameras, the models would be stationary, and the cameras would do all the moves.
Ah, to make it look like of course.
Yeah. The models were just hanging in midair.
Wow. And that makes perfect sense, because from the point of view of the camera, it's the models that are moving around. This is the foundation of relativity.
Right.
Emily the Strange is asking about the lightsaber sound. And we do have a little clip of that as well. That is clip number 4. And, you know, that has a very distinctive sound. Everybody knows what that sound is. You know, you hear that, and you know exactly what it is right away. Josh, have you got that clip queued up here?
I've been waiting for you, Obi-Wan. We meet again at last. The circle is now complete. When I left you, I was but the learner. Now I am the master.
Only a master of evil, Darth.
Your power's a weak, old man.
You can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
You should not have come back.
All right. I think that's enough lightsabering for now. Emily the Strange is saying in the chat room, the lightsaber was from something like an open circuit in a wire and causing some electrical interference, hence the hum. Is she anywhere near correct on that?
It's something like that. It was transformers or some kind of an electrical force that, and Ben would wave the microphone around it and creating the, what they would call the worldization of the sound. So you would hear like a pass by. So it's something electrical. I'm not sure how he did it.
Mm-hmm. Again, that was Ben's job to come up with all those cool sounds. Now, you mentioned something about premixing Chewbacca's sound. Something called the FS you mentioned, and that might be...
That was just a silly little antidote. Foley is footstep recordings, and it's the movement of their uniforms or whatever it is, you know, props. It's the recording inside of a studio of all of that material. When we were doing the Foley premixes, I made a special attempt to make Chewbacca's footsteps big and powerful, because he looked like he weighed about 500 pounds. And so, you know, big, fat, round feet, barefoot. Mm-hmm. And so we had these really nice, cool sounds, boom, 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 whenever he was running around. And when George heard us doing that, he looked and said, Wookiees don't make footsteps. sound. I said, well, he's so big. He says, no, take out all of his Foley sound. I don't want to hear it. So you hear everybody else running around, but you never hear a Wookiee footstep.
Why, they're supposed to be super light on their feet or something? That's amazing.
Maybe it's their fur. I don't know.
All right, the big walking carpet.
Yeah.
Did you have something in particular also to do with Darth Vader's voice?
Yeah. So we had Ben came in with the recording of James Earl Jones' voice and a various 35 millimeter recordings of like an aqualung, a breathing track. So Les Fresholtz, he was handling the voice. I was handling the breath. And I had like about 15 different types of breaths. And we did each line individually. And somebody else, Ben Burt, I think, had his hand on the Eventide harmonizer that would phase it. So, it was like live performance. We would roll forward and I would go, you know, it would kind of phase it. And then Darth's voice would come in. And then I'd pick the breath in. And so then, okay, we got that one. That was a really good take. We'll take that one. Next line. And so we did each line of the movie. It took like at least a full day, if not 2 days, of like four of us all doing something at the same time.
Wow. Here's a clip of Darth Vader's breathing and voice. Clip number 3.
The Death Star plans are not in the main computer.
Where are those transmissions you intercepted? What have you done with those plans?
We intercepted no transmissions. This is a consular ship. We're on a diplomatic mission.
If this is a consular ship, where is the ambassador? Commander, tear this ship apart until you found those plans and bring me the passengers. I want them alive.
Oh, man. You know, the other sound in that particular clip that's really creepy is when Vader finally kills the guy, you hear that crunchy sound like he's crushing his larynx. Oh, man, that just gives me the willies every time.
Yeah. And if you had to do Vader's voice today, it would be so simple.
Yeah.
With today's technology, with plugins and automated consoles and Pro Tools, you know, it would take you an hour to do Vader's voice, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Another innovation that you guys used was Dolby noise reduction, right?
Yeah. Dolby A noise reduction. If that didn't exist, the movie could not be made. You couldn't take that many recordings of original material and that was then pre-dubbed, and then those pre-dubs would go into a final. The tape hiss noise would have been so astronomical. So everything was Dolby A noise reduction to keep the hiss levels down. So without that, it couldn't have been made.
Yeah. Because you're doing all the pre-mixing and what I guess might sometimes be called bouncing, and all on tape. Yeah. I mean, this was not digital at all. Explain to us how Dolby A noise reduction works at a basic level.
Well, I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it has something that we used to call it stretching and unstretching. So they would take the noise floor, the circuitry would identify the lowest level of a recording being the surface hiss and expose it inside the Dolby unit. It would actually amplify it and identify it, and then in the decode process, suck it out. So hence stretching and unstretching. So if you ever heard a Dolby encoded noise reduction, you'd hear it extremely hissy. You'd have to decode it to take the hiss away.
Right. So it's a dual-ended system. It has to be encoded at one end and decoded at the other end. Now, Dolby A gave way to B and C. I don't know where SR came into that. Dolby B and C became consumer format, sort of. SR became more of a professional format. And I'm sure you've worked with all of those, and you've probably seen improvement in the way that that noise reduction works as that progressed, right?
Yeah. SR was really good. It came around in the 90s, right about 1989. And it was just a better version of the Dolby A noise reduction. Yeah.
Huh.
And today, today, no noise reduction is ever used because everything's digital and there is no noise. There's other problems, but there's no noise.
Yeah. So what are some of those other problems that you have to deal with in digital? That's a good question.
Well, there's headroom that we didn't have to deal with back then because with magnetic tape, there was compression that automatically happened. I mean, the tape can only hold so much.
In terms of high level, yeah.
Yeah. With digital, you have these ceilings, and so you can go into clipping quite easily. You can get snaps and crackles in digital if things are not operating properly, if the clock rate is drifting or things like that. It's just small little technical things in digital. But, you know, otherwise digital is terrific.
Yeah. I have to say I'm a total digophile, if you will. I really like digital projection. I think digital photography is superior to film in many ways. There are some Hollywood directors who will disagree with that. And I don't know where George Lucas falls on that. I don't know if you do either, but, you know, whether or not he typically seems to me to embrace new technologies as they come out. So I imagine he probably went to digital cinematography when he could.
I would think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And his attempt in 1996 to re-release the original Star Wars in digital, with some new, there were a couple of new scenes or one added scene, but there was a lot of digitally enhanced scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't really like that version. He tried his best that he could back then. I think if he did it again today, he would be much more successful at.
Yeah. I think the scene you might be thinking of is in the original, Jabba the Hutt shows up. In the original trilogy, he didn't show up till the third movie, but in the re-release, he came out. He shows up just before they blast off from Mos Eisley. And so that's the one scene I know that's definitely different. As Spire in the chat room is asking, was there a limit on the number of mixes you could do before hissing was a problem, even with Dolby A?
No, not really. There wasn't a limit, but you just always had to be aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. Beatmaster's asking, were any of the subsequent versions of the movie, when they were released, did you or anybody have to go back in and do anything to the sound?
Well, like I said, they re-released the original episode 4 in 1996. That was a remix. They found my original premixes and redid it. Gary Summers did that up at the ranch.
So, have you ever worked at the ranch? I've actually visited the studio there, the main orchestral soundstage, and man, oh man, is that a beautiful facility.
Yes, it's quite amazing. I was there just a month ago. I hadn't been there in about 10 years. I've done 5 movies up there over the years. I was there when they were building it. So I'm pretty familiar with it, but I'm still in awe every time I go there. It's the design and the craftsmanship is unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I totally agree. I heard a recording session there for a video game, actually, and the sound system in the control room is just phenomenal. And the acoustics in the main room, beautiful as well. Well, listen, obviously, Star Wars was really important in many ways, including a new standard, sort of leading the way to a new standard to theatrical exhibition and the creation, really, of THX as a quality assurance program. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, well, because we had such a problem in the original mix of trying to make these Altec A4 speakers respond properly, when George went back home, he was like, well, we have to fix this. We have to have better systems out there. You know, there were Star Wars was only released in 6-track 70 millimeter in about 50 theaters across the country because there weren't enough theaters who could play it. They didn't have the proper equipment. So George wanted good quality projection visually and good quality sound. And so he started this crusade, and he and Steven Spielberg, who followed up Star Wars with Close Encounters, they went on this crusade of demanding they told the theaters, you're not going to get any more of our movies until you upgrade your theaters. And this is how we want you to upgrade it. So a standard was made, and THX, they named it THX. George started to get into they toyed with the idea of actually making their own speakers. They partnered with JBL. That soon, they decided that was not a way to go. They don't want to be in the speaker manufacturing business.
So that's a whole different can of worms, yeah.
Yeah, so they just made the standard, and so they licensed that standard, THX standard, to any speaker manufacturer and any manufacturer of lenses and projection equipment. And so if you met their standard, you got THX approved, and you could now have a George Lucas, Steven Spielberg movie. And that's how thank God that they went on that crusade, because they literally upgraded the entire world.
The entire cinema experience. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that certification process, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it also included, you know, the room itself, the acoustics, the light, you know, how the colors of the walls, even, I suppose, in order to optimize the theater going experience.
Yes. And that still goes on today. Dolby has taken over that mantle, and they've come up with Dolby Vision, and they build their own theaters to their own specifications. And they've always worked with Lucasfilm throughout the years, and partnered with new technologies and stuff. So Dolby now has taken that on worldwide. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen some Dolby Vision movies in a Dolby Cinema with Dolby Atmos immersive sound?
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing.
Oh yeah. I've mixed a few of them.
I was going to say, have you mixed in Atmos? What do you think of that?
It's fabulous. Beauty and the Beast was Atmos,
yep.
And it was in Dolby Vision as well.
In fact, I saw it at a Dolby Cinema. Very impressive. Really nice. And in fact, I love how you and the people who did the sound mix things out into the hemispherical sound field. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. The early days, maybe not so much, but as people gained experience, I think they got a lot better at it.
Yeah. You used to have a 5.1, then you had a 7.1, and now you have rooms that have 50, 60, 70 speakers in there, and they're not specific channels, but you're completely surrounded with speakers, and we can do with them anything that we want. My first Atmos mix was maybe 4 years ago, and I didn't do that well. It took me like my fourth or fifth one before I'm completely comfortable, and I know how to use it. It's a process.
It's a process and a learning curve.
Yeah, it was a learning curve to the manufacturers. Also, Dolby itself had to learn more about their Atmos system as they went along.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever done anything in any of the other immersive formats, DTS:X, what they call MDA at the creation side, or Auro 3D?
Yeah. I've done all of them. They're all derivatives of the Atmos because they use the the metadata that is built into an Atmos mix can be used for DTSX and Oro and IMAX 12. So right. I recommend to everybody these days, just do all your mixes in Atmos and then down mix to everything else.
Okay, that makes sense. IMAX 12.1 is channel based as opposed to object based, which you were talking about earlier. You don't, with Atmos, you don't deal with, you don't think about channels. You think about where do I want this object and that object in 3D space? And then the Atmos system figures out which speakers to use to play it. Whereas I think IMAX is still channel based and you still have to think about it in channel, in terms of channels, right?
Yeah. But it's being steered by the metadata that's in your Atmos mix.
Right. Right. As Spire is asking, regarding THX quality assurance, so did somebody come around and go in to visit theaters? How did they verify that, that these theaters were conforming to the standards? I don't know if you know the answer to that. But
oh, yeah. They had field representatives that went all over the country. And yeah, you if you wanted one of these big six-track, 70-millimeter movies, you had to get it equipped and then get it certified. And there were field representatives that went to every single theater, and they would certify you, and then every 6 months you would get a checkup.
Oh, even better.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They really did a great job for about 10 years.
Drew Nielsen is asking, do you think channel beds are necessary anymore? Or can everything be done object only? We know that Atmos, for example, uses like I think a 7.1 channel quote unquote bed, and then objects flying around. But do you think that's even necessary anymore?
No, my Beauty and the Beast was all object, but it was set up to sort of mimic a 7.1. environment, so that when it was down mixed to 7.1 and 5.1, it wasn't completely different. So, I mean, yeah, you 7.1 is not going to go away, and 5.1 is not going to go away. So, you have to keep those things in mind. They shouldn't ever be gotten rid of. No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Web 9543 is asking a question that I often ask myself and others. Are you ever bothered by the high volume levels in theaters?
No, because most theaters play it low.
Really?
So, oh God!
I measure sound levels whenever I go to the theater, and they're typically very close to reference. That is 85 dBA, which my perception of that is that it's very low. That's not your perception? I mean, that's very high.
It's very high. Our reference level is 85. Every mixing stage in the world is set at 85. Mm-hmm. The theaters, I would say only 5% of them actually play it at 85. Most of them, the first thing they do is they turn it down 4 dB. I have seen theaters go down 15 dB.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yeah. I've walked into booths and I said, what on earth are you doing? I look at the thing and it's down 15 dB.
Wow. I just, in fact, I will tell you this. When I went to see Beauty and the Beast at the Burbank Dolby Cinema, I measured it at, I believe it was 8 dB over reference. Ooh. So they were actually cranking it.
I don't know about that.
Well, I'm sure you don't. That's a theater problem. But I did make a point to mention it to them because... You know, that was pretty darn loud.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that. Some mixes are just really loud. A lot of your superhero movies are just killer loud. And that's why theaters just turn them down.
Yeah, it's not hard to do. There's one master fader you can turn it down and it'd be fine. Well, anyway, we've come to the end of a fascinating conversation, and I want to thank you so much for being here, especially getting up so blasted early where you are in China. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, you're welcome. And just let me add a little something here. I'm sitting with my mixed tech. I'm sitting with my mixed tech, Mike Xu, here in China. They don't know anything about Star Wars. They were introduced to Star Wars only last year.
You're with, kidding. Really?
For The Force Awakens. Yeah. They've never seen the previous six movies. It was never really there. You can buy all six as a set on like on DVD or something like that.
Mm-hmm. On disc. But they were never theatrically released in China.
No, they'd never heard of it.
Wow. Well, Mike Xu, I hope you get a chance to watch them. The first one, first three in particular, most Star Wars fans would probably agree are the better ones. And the first one was phenomenal. I mean, it just, as you say, it blew everybody away. That first opening scene, we saw it earlier in this show with the spaceship coming over, was just a mind blower. No question about it. Yeah. Oh, did you work on any of the subsequent movies, by the way?
No. I wish I did, but I didn't. They moved on up to the ranch. Ben and I had a conversation about me moving up there and being a part of their team. I declined. The ranch isn't a place at that particular time in my life. I didn't really want to go up there. I liked Los Angeles.
Mm. This was the home of, I mean, you had so much more opportunity here than at the ranch where they were only, it's only one facility here. There are many in LA.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the other hand, I have to say, I love Northern California. I would have been pretty torn by such a decision myself.
Yeah. It's a fabulous place.
Yeah. Well, thank you again so much for being here. It's been a great hour of conversation, and I hope you can now get some sleep.
Yeah, we're going to go to breakfast right now.
Now, go to breakfast. Good. That's Mike Minkler. Okay. He's a re-recording engineer of now decades experience. One of his first jobs was on the original Star Wars movie, which we've been talking about today. As always, you can find me at avsforum.com, and you can email me at scott@twit.tv. You can also follow me on Twitter at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, my guest geeks are scheduled to be Chris Chinnick and Mike Heiss to talk about the Display Week conference that we all just attended this week. It's super inside baseball into the video display category. And really, really interesting stuff. So I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.